It was the only way to keep the Lannisters from learning that I had joined you. You are watched, as your brother was. Lord Varys reported every move Viserys made for years. Whilst I sat on the small council, I heard 100 such reports, and since the day you wed Khal Drogo, there has been an informer by your side, selling your secrets, trading whispers to the spider for gold and promises.
He cannot mean. You are mistaken. Danny looked at Jorah Mormon. Tell him he's mistaken. There's no informer, Sir Jorah, tell him. We crossed the Dothraki Sea together and the Red Waste. Her heart fluttered like a bird in a trap. Tell him, Jorah, tell him how he got it wrong.
The others take you, Selmy. Sir Jorah flung his long sword to the carpet. Khaleesi, it was only at the start, before I came to know you, before I came to love. Do not say that word.
She backed away from him. How could you? What did the usurper promise you?
Gold? Was it gold?
The Undying had said she would be betrayed twice more, once for gold and once for love.
Tell me what you were promised. Varys said I might go home.
He bowed his head.
I was going to take you home.
Her dragon sensed her fury. Viserion roared, and smoke rose grey from his snout. Drogon beat the air with black wings, and Rhaegal twisted his head back and belched flame.
I should say the word and burn the two of them.
Was there no one she could trust, no one to keep her safe?
Are all the knights of Westeros so false as you two? Get out, before my dragons roast you both. What does roast liar smell like? As foul as Bran Ben Sewers? Go!
Sir Barristan rose stiff and slow. For the first time he looked his age.
Where shall we go, Your Grace?
To hell, to Sir King Robert.
Danny felt hot tears on her cheeks. Drogon screamed, lashing his tail back and forth.
The others can have you both.
Go. Go away forever, both of you. The next time I see your faces, I'll have your traitors' heads off.
She could not say the words, though.
They betrayed me, but they saved me. But they lied.
You go.
My bear. My fierce, strong bear. What will I do without him? And the old man, my brother's friend.
You go. Go.
Where?
And then she knew. Tyrion. Tyrion dressed himself in darkness, listening to his wife's soft breathing from the bed they shared. She dreams, he thought, when Sansa murmured something softly, a name perhaps, though it was too faint to say, and turned onto her side. As man and wife they shared a marriage bed, but that was all. Even her tears she hoards to herself. He had expected anguish and anger when he told her of her brother's death, but Sansa's face had remained so still that for a moment he feared she had not understood. It was only later, with a heavy oaken door between them, that he heard her sobbing. Tyrion had considered going to her then, to offer what comfort he could.
No, he had to remind himself, she will not look for solace from a Lannister.
The most he could do was to shield her from the uglier details of the Red Wedding as they came down from the Twins. Sansa did not need to hear how her brother's body had been hacked and mutilated, he decided, nor how her mother's corpse had been dumped naked into the Green Fork in a savage mockery of House Tully's funeral customs. The last thing the girl needed was more fodder for her nightmares. It was not enough, though. He had wrapped his cloak around her shoulders and sworn to protect her, but that was as cruel a jape as the crown the Freys had placed atop the head of Robb Stark's direwolf after they'd sewn it onto his headless corpse. Sansa knew that as well. The way she looked at him, her stiffness,
when she climbed into their bed.
When he was with her, never for an instant could he forget who he was or what he was, no more than she did. She still went nightly to the God's Wood to pray, and Tyrion wondered if she were praying for his death. She had lost her home, her place in the world, and everyone she had ever loved or trusted. "Winter is coming," warned the Stark words, and truly it had come for them with a vengeance. "But it is high summer for House Lannister, so why am I so bloody cold?" He pulled on his boots, fastened his cloak with a lion's head brooch, and slipped out into the torchlit hall. There was this much to be said for his marriage. It had allowed him to escape Maegor's Holdfast. Now that he had a wife and household, his lord father had agreed that more suitable accommodations were required, and Lord Giles had found himself abruptly dispossessed of his spacious apartments atop the kitchen keep. And splendid apartments they were, too, with a large bedchamber, an adequate solar, a bath and dressing room for his wife, and small adjoining chambers for Pod and Sansa's maids. Even Bronn's cell by the stair had a window of sorts. Well, more an arrow slit, but it lets in light. The castle's main kitchen was just across the courtyard, true, but Tyrion found those sounds and smells infinitely preferable to sharing Maegor's with his sister. The less he had to see of Cersei, the happier he was like to be. Tyrion could hear Brella snoring as he passed her cell. Shay complained of that, but it seemed a small enough price to pay. Varys had suggested the woman to him. In former days she had run Lord Renly's household in the city, which had given her a deal of practice at being blind, deaf, and mute. Lighting a taper, he made his way back to the servants' steps and descended. The floors below his own were still, and he heard no footsteps but his own. Down he went, to the ground floor and beyond, to emerge in a gloomy cellar with a vaulted stone ceiling. Much of the castle was connected underground, and the kitchen keep was no exception. Tyrion waddled along a long dark passageway until he found the door he wanted, and pushed through. Within, the dragon skulls were waiting, and so was Shay.
"I thought my lord had forgotten me."
Her dress was draped over a black tooth near as tall as she was, and she stood within the dragon's jaws, nude.
"Balerion," he thought. Or was it Vhagar?
One dragon skull looked much like another. Just the sight of her made him hard.
"Come out of there."
"I won't."
She smiled her wickedest smile. "My lord will pluck me from the dragon's jaws, I know." But when he waddled closer, she leaned forward and blew out the taper. "She?"
He reached, but she spun and slipped free.
"You have to catch me."
Her voice came from his left.
"My lord must have played Munsters and Maidens when he was little."
"Are you calling me a Munster?"
"No more than I'm a maiden."
She was behind him, her steps soft against the floor.
"You need to catch me, all the same."
He did, finally, but only because she let herself be caught. By the time she slipped into his arms, he was flushed and out of breath from stumbling into dragon skulls. All that was forgotten in an instant when he felt her small breasts pressing against his face in the dark, her stiff little nipples brushing lightly over his lips and the scar where his nose had been. Tyrion pulled her down onto the floor.
"My giant,"
she breathed as he entered her.
"My giant's come to save me."
After, as they lay entwined amongst the dragon skulls, he rested his head against her, inhaling the smooth, clean smell of her hair.
"We should go back," he said reluctantly. "It must be near dawn. Sansa will be waking."
"You should give her dream wine," Shay said, "like Lady Tender does with lollies. A cup before she goes to sleep, and we could fuck in bed beside her without her waking." She giggled. "Maybe we should, some night. Would my lord like that?" Her hand found his shoulder and began to knead the muscles there.
"Your neck is hard as stone. What troubles you?"
Tyrion could not see his fingers in front of his face, but he ticked his woes off on them all the same. "My wife, my sister, my nephew, my father, the Tyrells." He had to move to the other hand. "Varys, Pycelle, Littlefinger, the Red Viper of Dawn." He had come to his last finger. "The face that stares back out of the water when I wash." Shay kissed his maimed, scarred nose.
"A brave face, a kind and good face. I wish I could see it now."
All the sweet innocence of the world was in her voice. "Innocence? Fool, she's a whore. All she knows of men is the bit between their legs. Fool, fool. Better you than me," Tyrion said. "We have a long day before us, both of us. You shouldn't have blown out that taper. How are we to find our clothing?" She laughed.
"Maybe we'll have to go naked.
And if we're seen, my lord father will hang you." Hiring Shay, as one of Sansa's maids, had given him an excuse to be seen talking with her, but Tyrion did not delude himself that they were safe. Varys had warned him.
"I gave Shay a false history, but it was meant for Lollies and Lady Tender. Your sister is of more suspicious mind. If she should ask me what I know..."
"You will tell her some clever lie."
"No, I will tell her that the girl is a common camp follower that you acquired before the battle on the Green Fork and brought to King's Landing against your lord father's express command. I will not lie to the queen."
"You have lied to her before? Shall I tell her that?" The eunuch sighed.
"That cuts more deeply than a knife, my lord. I've served you loyally, but I must also serve your sister when I can. How long do you think she would let me live if I were of no further use to her whatsoever? I have no fierce sellsword to protect me, no valiant brother to avenge me, only some little birds who whisper in my ear. With those whisperings, I must buy my life anew each day."
"Pardon me if I do not weep for you."
"I shall, but you must pardon me if I do not weep for Shay. I confess I do not understand what there is in her to make a clever man like you act such a fool."
"You might, if you were not a eunuch."
"Is that the way of it? A man may have wits or a bit of meat between his legs, but not both."
Varys tittered.
"Perhaps I should be grateful I was cut then."
The spider was right. Tyrion groped through the dragon-haunted darkness for his small clothes, feeling wretched. The risk he was taking left him tight as a drumhead, and there was guilt as well. "The others can take my guilt," he thought, as he slipped his tunic over his head. "Why should I feel guilty? My wife wants no part of me, and most especially not the part that seems to want her." Perhaps he ought to tell her about Shay. It was not as though he was the first man ever to keep a concubine. Sansa's own oh-so-honourable father had given her a bastard brother. For all he knew, his wife might be thrilled to learn that he was fucking Shay, so long as it spared her his unwelcome touch.
"No, I dare not."
Vows or no, his wife could not be trusted. She might be maiden between her legs, but she was hardly innocent of betrayal. She had once spilled her own father's plans to Cersei, and girls her age were not known for keeping secrets. The only safe course was to rid himself of Shay. "I might send her to Shataya," Tyrion reflected, reluctantly. In Shataya's brothel, Shay would have all the silks and gems she could wish for, and the gentlest, high-born patrons. It would be a better life by far than the one she had been living when he found her. Or, if she was tired of earning her bread on her back, he might arrange a marriage for her. Brunn, perhaps. The sellsword had never balked at eating off his master's plate, and he was a knight now, a better match than she could elsewise hope for. Or Sir Tallard. Tyrion had noticed that one gazing wistfully at Shay more than once. Why not? He's tall, strong, not hard to look upon, every inch the gifted young knight. Of course, Tallard knew Shay only as a pretty young lady's maid in service at the castle. If he wed her and then learned she was a whore.
My lord, where are you? Did the dragons eat you up?
No, here. He groped at a dragon's skull. I have found a shoe, but I believe it's yours.
My lord sounds very solemn. Have I displeased you?
No, he said too curtly. You always please me. And therein is our danger. He might dream of sending her away at times like this, but that never lasted long. Tyrion saw her dimly through the gloom, pulling a woolen sock up a slender leg. I can see. A vague light was leaking through the row of long, narrow windows set high in the cellar wall. The skulls of the Targaryen dragons were emerging from the darkness around them, black amidst grey. Day comes too soon. A new day, a new year, a new century. I survived the Green Fork and the Blackwater. I can bloody well survive King Joffrey's wedding. Shay snatched her dress down off the dragon's tooth and slipped it over her head.
I'll go up first. Brella will want help with the bathwater.
She bent over to give him one last kiss upon the brow.
My giant of Lannister. I love you so.
And I love you as well, sweetling. A whore she might well be, but she deserved better than what he had to give her. I will wed her to Sir Tallard. He seems a decent man. And tall.
Davos. He watched the sail grow for a long time, trying to decide whether he would sooner live or die. Dying would be easier, he knew. All he had to do was crawl inside his cave and let the ship pass by, and death would find him. For days now the fever had been burning through him, turning his bowels to brown water and making him shiver in his restless sleep. Each morning found him weaker. It will not be much longer, he'd taken to telling himself. If the fever did not kill him, thirst surely would. He had no fresh water here, but for the occasional rainfall that pooled in hollows on the rock. Only 3 days passed, or had it been four? On his rock it was hard to tell the days apart. His pools had been dry as old bone, and the sight of the bay, rippling green and grey all around him, had been almost more than he could bear. Once he began to drink seawater, the end would come swiftly, he knew. But all the same, he had almost taken that first swallow, so parched was his throat. A sudden squall had saved him. He had grown so feeble by then that it was all he could do to lie in the rain with his eyes closed and his mouth open, and let the water splash down on his cracked lips and swollen tongue. But afterward, he felt a little stronger, and the island's pools and cracks and crevices once more had brimmed with life. But that had been 3 days ago, or maybe four, and most of the water was gone now. Some had evaporated, and he had sucked up the rest. By the morrow he would be tasting the mud again, and licking the damp coal stones at the bottom of the depressions. And if not thirst or fever, starvation would kill him. His island was no more than a barren spire, jutting up out of the immensity of Blackwater Bay. When the tide was low, he could sometimes find tiny crabs along the stony strand, where he had washed ashore after the battle. They nipped his fingers painfully before he smashed them apart on the rocks to suck the meat from their claws and the guts from their shells. But the strand vanished whenever the tide came rushing in. and Davos had to scramble up the rock to keep from being swept out into the bay once more. The point of the spire was 15 feet above the water at high tide, but when the bay grew rough, the spray went even higher, so there was no way to keep dry, even in his cave, which was really no more than a hollow in the rock beneath an overhang. Nothing grew on the rock but lichen, and even the seabirds shunned the place. Now and again some gulls would land atop the spire, and Davos would try to catch one, but they were too quick for him to get close. He took to flinging stones at them, but he was too weak to throw with much force, so even when his stones hit, the gulls would only scream at him in annoyance and then take to the air. There were other rocks visible from his refuge, distant stony spires taller than his own. The nearest stood a good 40 feet above the water, he guessed, though it was hard to be sure at this distance. A cloud of gulls swirled about it constantly, and often Davos thought of crossing over to raid their nests. But the water was cold here, the current strong and treacherous, and he knew he did not have the strength for such a swim. That would kill him as sure as drinking sea water. Autumn in the narrow sea could often be wet and rainy, he remembered from years past. The days were not bad, so long as the sun was shining, but the nights were growing colder, and sometimes a wind would come gusting across the bay, driving a line of white caps before it, and before long Davos would be soaked and shivering. Fever and chills assaulted him in turn, and of late he had developed a persistent racking cough. His cave was all the shelter he had, and that was little enough. Driftwood and bits of charred debris would wash up on the strand during low tide, but he had no way to strike a spark or start a fire. Once in desperation, he had tried rubbing two pieces of driftwood against each other, but the wood was rotted, and his efforts earned him only blisters. His clothes were sodden as well, and he had lost one of his boots somewhere in the bay before he washed up here. Thirst, hunger, exposure. They were his companions, with him every hour of every day, and in time he had come to think of them as his friends. Soon enough one or other of his friends would take pity on him and free him from this endless misery. Or perhaps he would simply walk into the water one day and strike out for the shore that he knew lay somewhere to the north, beyond his sight. It was too far to swim, as weak as he was, but that did not matter. Davos had always been a sailor. He was meant to die at sea. "The gods beneath the waters have been waiting for me," he told himself. "It's past time I went to them." But now there was a sail. Only a speck on the horizon, but growing larger. A ship where no ship should be. He knew where his rock lay, more or less. It was one of a series of sea munts that rose from the floor of Blackwater Bay. The tallest of them jutted 100 feet above the tide, and a dozen lesser munts stood 30 to 60 feet high. Sailors called them Spears of the Merlin King, and he knew that for every one that broke the surface, a dozen lurked treacherously just below it. Any captain with any sense kept his course well away from them. Davos watched the sail swell through pale, red-rimmed eyes, and tried to hear the sound of the wind caught in the canvas. "She's coming this way." Unless she changed course soon, she would pass within hailing distance of his meagre refuge. It might mean life. If he wanted it. He was not sure he did. "Why should I live?" he thought as tears blurred his vision. "God be good, why? My sons are dead. Dale and Ellard, Marek, and Mathis, perhaps Devon as well. How can a father outlive so many strong young sons? How would I go on? I'm hollow shell. The crab's dead. There's nothing left inside. Don't they know that?" They had sailed up the Blackwater Rush, flying the fiery heart of the Lord of Light. Davos and Black Betha had been in the second line of battle, between Dale's wraith and Allard and Lady Maria. Merrick, his third-born, was Oarmaster and Fury, at the centre of the first line, while Mathis served as his father's second. Beneath the walls of the Red Keep, Stannis Baratheon's galleys had joined in battle with the boy king Joffrey's smaller fleet, and for a few moments the river had rung to the thrum of bowstrings and the crash of iron rams shattering oars and hulls alike. And then some vast beast had let out a roar, and green flames were all around them. Wildfire, Pyromancer's piss, the Jade Demon. Mathis had been standing at his elbow on the deck of Black Betha when the ship seemed to lift from the water. Davos found himself in the river, flailing as the current took him and spun him around and around. Upstream, the flames had ripped at the sky 50 feet high. He had seen Black Betha afire, and Fury, and a dozen other ships. Had seen burning men leaping into the water to drown. Wraith and Lady Maria were gone, sunk or shattered, or vanished behind a veil of wildfire. And there was no time to look for them, because the mouth of the river was almost upon him, and across the mouth of the river the Lannisters had raised a great iron chain. From bank to bank there was nothing but burning ships and wildfire. The sight of it seemed to stop his heart for a moment, and he could still remember the sound of it, the crackle of flames, the hiss of steam, the shrieks of dying men, and the beat of that terrible heat against his face as the current swept him down toward hell. All he needed to do was nothing. A few moments more, and he would be with his sons now, resting in the cool green mud on the bottom of the bay, with fish nibbling at his face. Instead, he sucked in a great gulp of air and dove, kicking for the bottom of the river. His only hope was to pass under the chain and the burning ships and the wildfire that floated on the surface of the water to swim hard for the safety of the bay beyond. Davos had always been a strong swimmer, and he'd worn no steel that day, but for the helm he'd lost when he lost Black Betha. As he knifed through the green murk, he saw other men struggling beneath the water, pulled down to drown beneath the weight of plate and mail. Davos swam past them, kicking with all the strength left in his legs, giving himself up to the current, the water filling his eyes. Deeper he went, and deeper still. With every stroke it grew harder to hold his breath. He remembered seeing the bottom soft and dim, as a stream of bubbles burst from his lips. Something touched his leg. A snag, or a fish, or a drowning man. He could not tell. He needed air by then, but he was afraid. Was he past the chain yet? Was he out in the bay? If he came up under a ship, he would drown. And if he surfaced amidst the floating patches of wild fire, his first breath would sear his lungs to ash. He twisted in the water to look up, but there was nothing to see but green darkness, and then he spun too far, and suddenly he could no longer tell up from down. Panic took hold of him. His hands flailed against the bottom of the river and sent up a cloud of mud that blinded him. His chest was growing tighter by the instant. He clawed at the water, kicking, pushing himself, turning, his lungs screaming for air, kicking, kicking, lost now in the river murk, kicking, 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 until he could kick no longer. When he opened his mouth to scream, the water came rushing in, tasting of salt, and Davos Seaworth knew that he was drowning. The next he knew, the sun was up, and he lay on a stony strand beneath a spire of naked stone, with the empty bay all around him, and a broken mast, a burned sail, and a swollen corpse beside him. The mast, the sail, and the dead man vanished with the next high tide, leaving Davos alone on his rock amidst the spears of the Merlin King. His long years as a smuggler had made the waters around King's Landing more familiar to him than any home he'd ever had, and he knew his refuge was no more than a speck on the charts, in a place that honest sailors steered away from, not toward. Though Davos himself had come by it once or twice in his smuggling days, the better to stay unseen.
When they find me dead here, if ever they do, perhaps they will name the rock for me, he thought. Onion Rock, they'll call it. It will be my tombstone and my legacy.
He deserved no more.
The father protects his children, the Septons taught.
But Davis had led his boys into the fire. Dale would never give his wife the child they had prayed for, and Allard, with his girl in Old Town, and his girl in King's Landing, and his girl in Bravos, they would all be weeping soon. Mathis would never captain his own ship as he dreamed. Marek would never have his knighthood.
How can I live when they are dead? So many brave knights and mighty lords have died, better men than me, and I born. Crawl inside your cave, Davis. Crawl inside, and shrink up small, and the ship will go away, and no one will trouble you ever again. Sleep on your stone pillow, and let the gulls peck out your eyes while the crabs feast on your flesh. You feasted on enough of them. You owe them. Hide, smuggler, hide, and be quiet, and die.
The sail was almost on him. A few moments more, and the ship would be safely passed, and he could die in peace. His hand reached for his throat, fumbling for the small leather pouch he always wore about his neck. Inside he kept the bones of the four fingers his king had shortened for him. On the day he made Davis a knight.
My luck.
His shortened fingers patted at his chest, groping, finding nothing. The pouch was gone, and the finger bones with them. Stannis could never understand why he'd kept the bones.
To remind me of my king's justice, he whispered through cracked lips.
But now they were gone.
The fire took my luck as well as my son's.
In his dreams the river was still aflame, and demons danced upon the waters with fiery whips in their hands, while men blackened and burned beneath the lash.
Mother, have mercy, Davis prayed. Save me, gentle mother. Save us all. My luck is gone. And my sons.
He was weeping freely now, salt tears streaming down his cheeks.
The fire took it all. The fire.
Perhaps it was only wind blowing against a rock, or the sound of the sea on the shore. But for an instant, Davis Seaworth heard her answer.
"You call the fire,"
she whispered, her voice as faint as the sound of waves in a seashell, sad and soft.
"You burned us. Burned us. Burned us." "It was her!" Davis cried. Mother, don't forsake us. It was her who burned you, the red woman, Melisande, her.
He could see her, her heart-shaped face, the red eyes, the long, coppery hair, the red gowns moving like flames as she walked, a swirl of silk and satin. She had come from Ashai in the east. She had come to Dragonstone and won Selyse and her queen's men for her alien god. And then the king, Stannis Baratheon himself. He had gone so far as to put the fiery heart on his banners, the fiery heart of R'hllor, Lord of Light, and God of Flame and Shadow. At Melisande's urging, he had dragged the Seven from their sceptred Dragonstone and burned them before the castle gates, and later had burned the Godswood at Storm's End as well, even the Heart Tree, a huge white weirwood, with a solemn face.
"It was her work," Davis said again, more weakly. "Her work and yours, Onion Knight. You rode her into Storm's End in the black of night, so she might loose her shadow child. You are not guiltless, no. You rode beneath her banner and flew it from your mast. You watched the Seven burn at Dragonstone, and did nothing. She gave the father's justice to the fire, and the mother's mercy, and the wisdom of the crone, smith and stranger, maid and warrior, she burned them all to the glory of her cruel god, and you stood and held your tongue. Even when she killed old Maester Cresson, even then, you did nothing.
The sail was 100 yards away and moving fast across the bay. In a few more moments it would be past him and dwindling. Sir Davis Seaworth began to climb his rock. He pulled himself up with trembling hands, his head swimming with fever. Twice his maimed fingers slipped on the damp stone and he almost fell, but somehow he managed to cling to his perch. If he fell, he was dead, and he had to live. For a little while more, at least, there was something he had to do. The top of the rock was too small to stand on safely, as weak as he was, so he crouched and waved his fleshless arms.
"Ship!"
he screamed into the wind.
"Ship here! Here!"
From up here, he could see her more clearly, the lean, striped hull, the bronze figurehead, the billowing sail. There was a name painted on her hull, but Davis had never learned to read.
"Ship!"
he called again.
"Help me! Help me!"
A crewman on her forecastle saw him and pointed. He watched as other sailors moved to the gunwale to gape at him. A short while later, the galley's sail came down. Her oars slid out, and she swept around towards his refuge. She was too big to approach the rock closely, but 30 yards away she launched a small boat. Davis clung to his rock and watched it creep toward him. 4 men were rowing, while a 5th sat in the prow.
"You!"
the 5th man called out, when they were only a few feet from his island.
"You, up on the rock! Who are you?"
"A smuggler who rose above himself," thought Davis. "A fool who loved his king too much and forgot his guards."
"I..."
his throat was parched, and he had forgotten how to talk. The words felt strange on his tongue, and sounded stranger in his ears.
"I was in the battle. I was a captain, a knight. I was a knight."
"Aye, sir," the man said, "and serving which king?"
The galley might be Joffrey's, he realized suddenly. If he spoke the wrong name now, she would abandon him to his fate. But no, her hull was striped. She was Lysine. She was Salador Sans. The mother sent her here. The mother in her mercy. She had a task for him.
"Stannis lives," he knew then. "I have a king still, and sons. I have other sons, and a wife loyal and loving."
How could he have forgotten? The mother was merciful indeed.
"Stannis!"
he shouted back at the Lyseni.
"Gods be good! I serve King Stannis!"
"Aye,"
said the man in the boat.
"And so do we."
Sansa.
That was such a sweet dream,
Sansa thought drowsily. She had been back in Winterfell, running through the Godswood with her lady. Her father had been there, and her brothers, all of them warm and safe. If only dreaming could make it so. She threw back the coverlets. I must be brave. Her torments would soon be ended one way or the other. If Lady was here, I would not be afraid. Lady was dead, though. Rob, Bran, Rickon, Arya, her father, her mother, even Septa Mordane. All of them dead but me. She was alone in the world now. Her lord husband was not beside her, but she was used to that. Tyrion was a bad sleeper, and often rose before the dawn. Usually she found him in the solar, hunched beside a candle, lost in some old scroll or leather-bound book. Sometimes the smell of the morning bread from the ovens took him to the kitchens,
and sometimes he would climb up to the roof garden or wander all alone down Traitor's Walk. She threw back the shutters and shivered as goose prickles rose along her arms. There were clouds massing in the eastern sky, pierced by shafts of sunlight.
They looked like two huge castles afloat in the morning sky.
Sansa could see their walls of tumblestone, their mighty keeps and barbicans. Wispy banners swirled from atop their towers and reached for the fast-fading stars. The sun was coming up behind them, and she watched them go from black to grey to a thousand shades of rose and gold and crimson. Soon the wind mushed them together, and there was only one castle where there had been two. She heard the door open as her maids brought the hot water for her bath. They were both new to her service. Tyrion said the women who tended her previously had all been Cersei's spies, just as Sansa had always suspected. "Come see," she told them. "There's a castle in the sky." They came to have a look.
"It's made of gold."
Shay had short, dark hair and bold eyes. She did all that was asked of her, but sometimes she gave Sansa the most insolent looks.
"A castle all of gold. There's a sight I'd like to see."
"A castle, is it?"
Brella had to squint.
"That tower's tumbling over. Looks like it's all ruins, that is."
Sansa did not want to hear about falling towers and ruined castles. She closed the shutters and said, "We are expected at the Queen's breakfast. Is my lord husband in the solar?"
"No, my lady," said Brella. "I have not seen him."
"Might be he went to see his father," Shay declared. "Might be the king's hand had need of his counsel."
Brella gave a sniff.
"Lady Sansa, you'll be wanting to get into the tub before the water gets too cool."
Sansa let Shay pull her shift over her head and climbed into the big wooden tub. She was tempted to ask for a cup of wine to calm her nerves. The wedding was to be at midday in the great Sept of Baelor across the city, and come evenfall the feast would be held in the throne room. 1,000 guests and 77 courses, with singers and jugglers and mummers. But first came breakfast in the Queen's ballroom for the Lannisters and the Tyrell men. The Tyrell women would be breaking their fast with Margaery, and 100-odd knights and lordlings. "They have made me a Lannister," Sansa thought bitterly. Brella sent Shay to fetch more hot water while she washed Sansa's back.
"You're trembling, my lady."
"The water is not hot enough," Sansa lied. Her maids were dressing her when Tyrion appeared, Podrick Payne in tow.
"You look lovely, Sansa."
He turned to his squire.
"Pod, be so good as to pour me a cup of wine."
"There will be wine at breakfast, my lord," Sansa said. "There's wine here. You don't expect me to face my sister sober, surely?"
"It's a new century, my lady. The 300th year since Aegon's conquest."
The dwarf took a cup of bread from Podrick and raised it high.
"To Aegon! What a fortunate fellow! Two sisters, two wives, and three big dragons. What more could a man ask for?"
He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. The imp's clothing was soiled and unkempt, Sansa noticed. It looked as though he'd slept in it.
"Will you be changing into fresh garb, my lord? Your new doublet is very handsome."
"The doublet is handsome, yes." Tyrion put the cup aside. "Come, Pod, let us see if we can find some garments to make me look less dwarfish. I would not want to shame my lady wife." When the imp returned a short time later, he was presentable enough, and even a little taller. Podrick Payne had changed as well, and looked almost a proper squire for once, although a rather large red pimple in the fold beside his nose spoilt the effect of his splendid purple, white, and gold raiment.
"He is such a timid boy."
Sansa had been wary of Tyrion squire at first. He was a Payne, cousin to Sir Ilyen Payne, who had taken her father's head off. However, she had soon come to realize that Pod was as frightened of her as she was of his cousin. Whenever she spoke to him, he turned the most alarming shade of red. "Are purple, gold, and white the colours of house pain, Podrick?" she asked him politely.
No, I mean, yes,
he blushed.
"The colours, our arms are purple and white checky, my lady, with gold coins in the checks. Purple and white, both."
He studied her feet.
"There's a tale behind those coins," said Tyrion. "No doubt Pod will confide it to your toes one day. Just now we are expected at the Queen's ballroom, however. Shall we?"
Sansa was tempted to beg off. I could tell him that my tummy was upset, or that my moon's blood had come. She wanted nothing more than to crawl back in bed and pull the drapes. I must be brave, like Rub, she told herself as she took her lord husband stiffly by the arm. In the Queen's ballroom they broke their fast on honey cakes baked with blackberries and nuts, gammon steaks, bacon, fingerfish crisped in breadcrumbs, autumn pears, and a Dornish dish of onions, cheese, and chopped eggs cooked up with fiery peppers.
"Nothing like our tea breakfast to whet one's appetite for the 77-course feast to follow,"
Tyrion commented as their plates were filled. There were flagons of milk and flagons of mead, and flagons of a light sweet golden wine to wash it down. Musicians strolled among the tables, piping and fluting and fiddling, while Ser Dontos galloped about on his broomstick horse, and Moonboy made farting sounds with his cheeks and sang rude songs about the guests. Tyrion scarce touched his food, Sansa noticed, though he drank several cups of the wine. For herself she tried a little of the Dornish eggs, but the peppers burned her mouth. Otherwise she only nibbled at the fruit and fish and honey cakes. Every time Joffrey looked at her, her tummy got so fluttery that she felt as though she'd swallowed a bat. When the food had been cleared away, the Queen solemnly presented Joff with the wife's cloak that he would drape over Margaery's shoulders. "It is the cloak I donned when Robert took me for his queen, the same cloak my mother Lady Joanna wore when wed to my lord father. Sansa thought it looked threadbare, if truth be told, but perhaps because it was so used. Then it was time for gifts. It was traditional in the Reach to give presents to bride and groom on the morning of their wedding. On the morrow they would receive more presents as a couple, but today's tokens were for their separate persons. From Jalabar Zoe, Joffrey received a great bow of golden wood and quiver of long arrows fletched with green and scarlet feathers. From Lady Tanda, a pair of supple riding boots. From Sir Kevin, a magnificent red leather jousting saddle. A red gold brooch, wrought in the shape of a scorpion, from the Dornishman, Prince Oberon. Silver spurs from Sir Adam Marbrant. A red silk tawny pavilion from Lord Mathis Rowan. Lord Paxter Redwine brought forth a beautiful wooden model of the war galley of 200 oars being built even now on the Arbor. If it please your grace, she would be called King Joffrey's Valor, he said, and Joffrey allowed that he was very pleased indeed.
I will make it my flagship when I sail to Dragonstone to kill my traitor uncle Stannis, he said.
He plays the gracious king today. Joffrey could be gallant, when it suited him, Sansa knew, but it seemed to suit him less and less. Indeed, all his courtesy vanished at once when Tyrion presented him with their own gift, a huge old book called Lives of Four Kings, bound in leather and gorgeously illuminated. The king leafed through it with no interest.
"And what is this, uncle?"
"A book." Sansa wondered if Joffrey moved those fat, wormy lips of his when he read.
"A Grand Maester case history of the reigns of Daeron the Young Dragon, Baelor the Blessed, Aegon the Unworthy, and Daeron the Good,"
her small husband answered. "A book every king should read, Your Grace," said Sir Kevin.
"My father had no time for books,"
Joffrey shoved the tome across the table. "If you read less, Uncle Imp, perhaps Lady Sansa would have a baby in her belly by now." He laughed, and when the king laughs, the court laughs with him. "Don't be sad, Sansa. Once I've gotten Queen Margaery with child, I'll visit your bedchamber and show my little uncle how it's done." Sansa reddened. She glanced nervously at Tyrion, afraid of what he might say. This could turn as nasty as the bedding had at their own feast. But for once the dwarf filled his mouth with wine instead of words. Lord Mace Tyrell came forward to present his gift, a golden chalice 3 feet tall, with 2 ornate curved handles and 7 faces glittering with gemstones.
7 faces for your grace's 7 kingdoms, the bride's father explained.
He showed them how each face bore the sigil of one of the great houses. Ruby lion, emerald rose, onyx stag, silver trout, blue jade falcon, opal sun, and pearl direwolf.
"A splendid cup," said Joffrey, "but we'll need to chop the wolf off and put a squid in its place, I think."
Sansa pretended that she had not heard.
"Margaery and I shall drink deep at the feast, good father."
Joffrey lifted the chalice above his head for everyone to admire.
"The damn thing's as tall as I am," Tyrion muttered in a low voice. "Half a chalice, and Joff will be falling down drunk."
"Good," she thought. "Perhaps he'll break his neck." Lord Tywin waited until last to present the king with his own gift, a longsword. Its scabbard was made of cherrywood, gold, and oiled red leather, studded with golden lions' heads. The lions had ruby eyes, she saw. The ballroom fell silent as Joffrey unsheathed the blade and thrust the sword above his head. Red and black ripples in the steel shimmered in the morning light.
"Magnificent," declared Mathis Rowan. "A sword to sing of, sire," said Lord Redwine.
"A king's sword," said Sir Kevin Lannister.
King Joffrey looked as if he wanted to kill someone right then and there, he was so excited. He slashed at the air and laughed.
"A great sword must have a great name, my lords. What shall they call it?"
Sansa remembered Lion's Tooth, the sword Arya had flung into the trident, and Heart Eater, the one he'd made her kiss before the battle. She wondered if he'd want Margaery to kiss this one. The guests were shouting out names for the new blade. Joffrey dismissed a dozen before he heard one he liked.
"Widow's Wail," he cried. "Yes, it shall make many a widow, too."
He slashed again.
"And when I face my uncle Stannis, it will break his magic sword clean in two."
Joff tried a down cut, forcing Sir Balon Swan to take a hasty step backward. Laughter rang through the hall at the look on Sir Balon's face.
"Have a care, your grace," Sir Adam Marbrunt warned the king. "Valyrian steel is perilously sharp."
"I remember."
Joffrey brought Widow's Wail down in a savage two-handed slice onto the book that Tyrion had given him. The heavy leather cover parted at a stroke.
"Sharp, I tell you. I am no stranger to Valyrian steel."
It took him half a dozen further cuts to hack the thick tome apart, and the boy was breathless by the time he was done. Sansa could feel her husband struggling with his fury as Sir Osmond Kettleback shouted,
"I pray you, never turn that wicked edge on me, sire. See that you never give me cause, sir."
Joffrey flicked a chunk of Lives of Four Kings off the table at sword point, then slid Widow's Wail back into its scabbard.
"Your grace," Sir Garland Tyrell said, "perhaps you did not know, in all of Westeros there were but 4 copies of that book illuminated in Caith's own hand."
"Now there are 3.
Joffrey undid his old sword belt to don his new one.
"You and Lady Sansa owe me a better present, Uncle Imp. This one is all chopped to pieces."
Tyrion was staring at his nephew with his mismatched eyes.
"Perhaps a knife, sire, to match your sword. A dagger of the same fine Valyrian steel, with a dragonbone hilt, say."
Joffrey gave him a sharp look.
"You? Yes. A dagger to match my sword. Good."
He nodded.
A gold hilt with rubies in it, dragonbone, is too plain."
"As you wish, your grace."
Tyrion drank another cup of wine. He might have been all alone in Isola for all the attention he paid Sansa, but when the time came to leave for the wedding, he took her by the hand. As they were crossing the yard, Prince Oberyn of Dorn fell in beside them, his black-haired paramour on his arm. Sansa glanced at the woman curiously. She was base-born and unwed, and had borne two bastard daughters for the prince. But she did not fear to look even the queen in the eye. She had told her that this Ilaria worshipped some Lycian love goddess.
"She was almost a whore when he found her, milady," her maid confided, "and now she's near a princess."
Sansa had never been this close to the Dornish woman before.
"She's not truly beautiful," she thought, "but something about her draws the eye.
I once had the great good fortune to see the Citadel's copy of Lives of Four Kings," Prince Oberyn was telling her lord husband. "The illuminations were wondrous to behold, but Caith was too kind by half to King Viserys."
Tyrion gave him a sharp look.
"Too kind? He scans Viserys shamefully, in my view. It should have been Lives of Five Kings."
The prince laughed.
"Viserys hardly reigned a fortnight."
"He reigned more than a year," said Tyrion.
Oberyn gave a shrug.
"A year or a fortnight, what does it matter? He poisoned his own nephew to gain the throne, and then did nothing once he had it."
"Baelor starved himself to death fasting," said Tyrion. "His uncle served him loyally as hand, as he had served the young dragon before him. Viserys might have only reigned a year, but he ruled for 15, while Daeron warred and Baelor prayed."
He made a sour face.
"And if he did remove his nephew, can you blame him? Someone had to save the realm from Baelor's follies."
Sansa was shocked.
"But Baelor the Blessed was a great king. He walked the Bone Way barefoot to make peace with Dorn, and rescued the Dragon Knight from a snake pit. The vipers refused to strike him because he was so pure and holy."
Prince Oberyn smiled.
"If you were a viper, my lady, would you want to bite a bloodless stick like Baelor the Blessed? I'd sooner save my fangs for someone juicier."
"My prince is playing with you, Lady Sansa," said the woman Ilaria Sand. "The Septons and singers like to say that the snakes did not bite Baelor, but the truth is very different. He was bitten 50 times, and should have died from it."
"If he had, Viserys would have reigned 12 years, said Tyrion, "and the Seven Kingdoms might have been better served. Some believe Baelor was deranged by all that vellum."
"Yes," said Prince Oberyn, "but I have seen no snakes in this red keep of yours. So how do you account for Joffrey?"
"I prefer not to." Tyrion inclined his head stiffly. "If you will excuse us, our litter awaits."
The dwarf helped Sansa up inside and clambered awkwardly after her.
"Close the curtains, my lady, if you'll be so good."
"Must we, my lord?"
Sansa did not want to be shut behind the curtains. "The day is so lovely."
"The good people of King's Landing are like to throw dung at the litter if they see me inside it. Do us both a kindness, my lady. Close the curtains."
She did as he bid her. They sat for a time as the air grew warm and stuffy around them.
"I was sorry about your book, my lord," she made herself say. "It was Joffrey's book. He might have learned a thing or two if he'd read it."
He sounded distracted. "I should have known better. I should have seen a good many things. Perhaps a dagger will please him more." When the dwarf grimaced, His scar tightened and twisted. The boy's earned himself a dagger, wouldn't you say? Thankfully, Tyrion did not wait for her reply.